Hello and welcome to this bonus episode of The Storyteller Naked Villainy. There was a lot going on at the end of the trial, a huge amount of emotion, and the focus was on Kit Harrison, the man whose fate had just been decided. Dr. Brenda Page was in our thoughts, of course, but that day was all about Kit. So in this episode, I'm going to let you hear from some of the main people in the series, be it their hope for what might happen in the event of justice being served when interviewed 2 decades ago or more recently, and the reaction to the verdict from others. I'll begin with letting you hear a snippet as Alison Shaw and I left the courtroom. We don't say very much, but you can hear that our tears.
I thought he might have reacted, Peyton. He's probably just focusing on his appeal already.
Certainly.
Either.
Yeah.
That's
right.
Yeah.
God. Even after it. Like,
oh no.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
Can't help.
It's a very interesting
thing. Oh, God.
In case you couldn't hear that, Alison was saying it was very dramatic. Just after this, I was approached by the documentary team who were covering the trial. I was interviewed almost every day by them to give my feedback on the evidence due to my history with the case. However, powers above decided to cut me out entirely and just focus on what happened in the courtroom. But my mic was still rolling, so I recorded being asked by the director how I felt. You heard the first part of this in the main episode. But here's what I went on to say after I'd had a good cry.
You as well kind of lived with this for like...
Yeah. I rewatched this morning, actually. Excuse me. This morning. I don't know why I chose this morning. Horribly early. I watched the rushes from the documentary I filmed 20 years ago of me confronting him. And I remember the adrenaline and... I'm chasing after him. Mr. Harrison, he'll be annoyed I called him Mr. Harrison. I'm sure he was desperate to say doctor. And I start off, you know, explaining who I am, and I want to talk to him about the murder of his ex-wife. And straight from the offset, we know he's not going to play ball. So I don't like ambush journalism, but I really had no choice but to do it then. It was the only, you know, it was the only person to ask him that question out loud besides the police in 1978 on the 14th of July. No one else had done it. So I'm chasing after him saying, you know, why haven't you contacted the police in the 25 years to find out, you know, if you loved her so much, why haven't you found out how the inquiry's going? Why aren't you taking this opportunity to, you know, shout from the rooftop to her innocence and support us trying to find her killer kind of thing? But I repeatedly ask him, did you kill her? You had an interim interdict out against you. You'd been threatening violence. People believe it's you. Did you kill her? And he sort of, he looks furious and he bats away the microphone. He's 62 then, and he looks very different. He looks, you know, he's a man then. He's a man that you can see as a kind of, you know, more of a threat than an 82-year-old. And, you know, it's 20 years, he's changed a lot. But he's the same person, and he's the same person in his 30s who killed his wife, who's only 32, his ex-wife. I've been invested in this case, you know, for more than 20 years. I met her family at the time, I met her friends. I learned how amazing she was. I felt connected to her in the dramatic reconstruction my best friend played, Brenda. And it's one I've always wanted them to have a completion for her family, to have, the closure doesn't exist with murder, but a resolution and justice. And honestly, I didn't think it would ever happen because COVID and the delays. I mean, his arrest was a surprise, to be honest. I knew they'd been reinvestigating it. But finally, to get the court case done and complete and a guilty verdict feels huge. It's, you know, almost half my life I've known about Brenda. And she'd have been brilliant. I'd have loved to have met her. I'd have wanted to be her friend. And it's an honour, privilege beyond to be able to be a kind of voice for her now, to show the world how amazing she was, and the tragedy of her death and expose this true evil of Kit Harrison, even at this age.
Did you have eyes on him at all?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Can you talk me through that?
I was scribbling away furiously, but to be honest, when the guilty, I was leaning forward. And it's hard to say. It's not that he didn't react at all, but he wasn't showing much that we could see. And then when he stood up and the judge was, you know, sentencing him, it's hard to describe his expression, but then he's just been told he's going to spend the rest of his life, he will die in prison unless he lives beyond 102. And he's got to turn around and get his handcuffs, and it was as though he was being, I don't know, offered a, oh, can you put this wristband on? And then he's like, oh, what about my bag? You know, this, like, just such a matter-of-fact, practical thing. My bag and my hat are there. And they're like, well, we'll deal with it. And then it was quite sad, though, seeing him being taken out of the dock and taken out this side door. I'm really annoyed with myself that I felt a bit sad about it, but you kind of do think, you just can't help it. You know, you can't detach completely from the visual of an old man. And right enough, his McConaughey said, given his life, he will find it extremely difficult to exist in prison. And he will, but tough. Tough, he deserves it.
And what did you make of the judge's comments? Is it?
Oh, wow, yeah. I don't know how well I got them down, to be honest, and I haven't had time to look over them. The judge, I thought, Lord Richardson, he did not hold back. And he's clearly has read the victim statement, which we didn't hear from her family, and that had moved him.
But like you say, he did not hold back.
No, he didn't. It's really interesting, and this always happens with these cases, that they have to be utterly objective and impartial, almost, when they're directing the jury. So they're like, now, if you're going to believe this person, if you're going to be that person. But once they're found guilty, they don't hold back. It's like, what you did was evil. It was premeditated. It was, I think he used the word vicious. He didn't hold back with his words. And again, hearing those words come from such a well-spoken, as they always are, judges, again, he deserved those words. It is those moments when you're sitting in court and you can't help but think, this feels like a movie. But this is real life. And Brenda lost her life, and we can't forget that. And his words were accurate and real, and Kit Harrison's fate is real. And he will die in prison. And he deserves it.
I'm sure Rita would have liked to be here, but a nephew was here.
Yeah, I looked over at Rita's nephew and his wife, and I saw how emotional they were, but there was smiles and there was tears, and I actually can't, I'm quite looking forward to seeing them and just not congratulating them, because it's such a, there's nothing happy here, but just say that I'm so glad for them, and I'm so glad for Rita, and I bet the first thing they went and did was call Rita and tell her on the phone, and I can't imagine what it was like getting that call. She'll have been, you know, she's at home in Ipswich. To get that phone call, for the phone to ring, I can't imagine what it would be like for her to pick up the phone and be. And I'm sure the first word would be guilty, before hello, guilty. And I cannot even begin to think how that would feel for her. Yeah. Oh.
There's a lot of kind of press and interest in this, but even for the city of Aberdeen.
Yeah.
You know, it has kind of lingered, this case.
Yeah.
It's one that.
Yeah, there's two cases that have sort of remained unsolved in Aberdeen, this one, and then there was also, round about the same time actually, the murder of a taxi driver, George Murdoch. And, you know, every 5 years, every 10 years, a mention is made. And it was the 25th anniversary when I made the documentary, so that's 20 years ago. And that sort of brought it up again. So I guess my generation of people learned about it if they watched it or heard about it at the time. So it's one that, you know, if you said her name, people would be like, oh yeah, you know, the older generation would know exactly, but the younger generation are like, oh, who's that? Oh yes, the scientist. Oh, the Allen Street one. And then unfortunately always it was attached with, oh, was she not the escort girl? And I think that's something that this court case hopefully has put to bed finally, and through this documentary and my work, that we're not going to diminish everything else that she was, because she had a very brief part-time job to get a bit of extra money having dinner with men. The victim shaming, blaming, women blaming has to stop. And and her legacy has to be her brilliance, not just as a scientist, but as a human being.
Immediately after this, I saw David Burnside, Kit's solicitor for many decades. He made a big effort to be there for the verdict, and I grabbed him for a quick word. Apologies for the wind noise in the recording.
What did you think about that?
I did think that it would be a majority verdict. I think that the defence team put up a tremendous fight, and obviously caused the jury to think. It's been a long time coming, and it's been hellish for the family. It's also, of course, he's been the prime suspect since 1978. The sword of Damocles was hanging over him. So it's closure, but not in a pleasant way for him.
Yeah. How did you feel seeing him, watching this man aged 82 be led away?
A sense of sadness. I've been interested in the case since 1978, and from that point of view, I've lived with it and the ups and downs. So it's sad to see someone who will die in prison.
Mm, yeah. And do you feel that justice has finally been done?
Well, it's the verdict of the jury, and of course it's subject to the right of appeal, but mm. I think that in all probability we've now reached a stage where justice has been done.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
In all probability, we've reached a stage where justice has been done. That's the most diplomatic way he could say that the man he plucked out of police custody on July the 15th, 1978, was guilty. While we were outside, and as I predicted, Brenda's nephew, Chris Ling, and his wife, Belinda, were upstairs in a private room. He shook hands with Alec Prentice and thanked him. Then he phoned his mother, Rita, in Ipswich. When he told her of the news, she said, oh, what a relief. Sad to be happy about such a sad event. And when her daughter-in-law told her the judge had given a beautiful tribute to Brenda, she said, oh, I only wish Mum and Brenda would know. With barely a moment for them to absorb the enormity of it all, Chris and Belinda came out onto the front steps of the court building, and Chris read out his statement, which you've heard in the main episode. We all then waited in the cold for the 82-year-old to be led out in handcuffs. When he finally emerged, you could see from his face that Kit did not enjoy the snapping of cameras from the huddle waiting on the pavement, capturing every frame of his short walk from the side door of the court and into the large prison transporter van. He ignored the shouts from journalists, asking whether he regretted his actions. With him on his way to the nearest prison in Peterhead, 30-plus miles north of Aberdeen and roughly 45 minutes' drive, I finally made my way home west of Aberdeen. My mum would be waiting inside the house for me. She's had two catastrophic strokes over the past decade, and they've left their mark, so her reaction to serious subjects is a little different these days. So I sat in the car for a moment to gather myself before going inside, and I hit record.
I've just pulled up at my parents' house, and I'm still decompressing, but wow, that moment the verdict comes back, there's nothing like it. You cannot explain it. You watch it in movies and on TV, but when you're in a courtroom and people are filing back in and sitting down, and there's sort of procedural things of have you got your spokesperson, etc., and then there's always that pause. And then they say the word guilty. And you just, there's this collective energy that just explodes in that moment when you're in a courtroom. Nothing like it. happen like it.
And it's true, you cannot truly understand until you've been in a courtroom and experienced it. But with this podcast, I've hopefully given you, the listeners, the closest immersion into what that feels like. It feels like a lifetime ago that I played you the recordings of Hamish Keir and Forbes Robertson, Kit and Brenda's bosses. They're both dead now, but they had hopes for what might happen. And I'll let you hear what they say now, starting with Professor Robertson, who was the head of genetics at Aberdeen University.
Well, yes, when one does think back on it, one naturally wonders why the account hasn't finally been squared, hopes that ultimately it will be. But naturally, it's not something that one reflects on every day.
And now here's Professor Hamish Keir, who is former head of biochemistry at Aberdeen University, and his reflections on Dr. Brenda Page.
A few happy years professionally and academically and scientifically, a life which was extremely productive and helpful to medical research, being terminated prematurely. She was a great leader as well. I perhaps should have emphasised that earlier, and she ran a good ship in cytogenetics. And at the time, of course, she was missed, and it's a pity to think that it never came to fruition.
You'll remember Dr. James Douglas, Brenda's former neighbour who had to identify her body. He drove from the west of Scotland to attend much of the trial. Just imagine that. Something he could have left in the past or observed on the news like everybody else, but he wanted to be there. This is part of the interview, which was recorded before the verdict.
What's your hope for this?
My hope for it? Well, I hope that justice is done. That I'm confident when I'm looking at the jury and the legal process. It's been fascinating sitting in a high court, listening to the meticulous way that trials are conducted, meticulous way that the accused rights are protected. When I listened to the recorded evidence in the police station and I heard those two police officers giving him every chance to say, do you want a lawyer, treating him respectfully, and all the rest of it, and the meticulous way that the court was run today with the judge directing the jury, and both the defence and the advocate deputy leading the Crown case and the defence, meticulous in the way that they were doing that. And I've got confidence in the British justice system and the jury process.
Do you wish it happened sooner?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, obviously only the police and the Crown Prosecution Service can answer the question about why it's taken 45 years. Obviously the advances in genetics had to occur, but some of those were in place. They've been advancing all those years, but could they have run this prosecution 20 years ago? I don't know. I mean, there are all sorts of complex legal things about double jeopardy and circumstantial evidence, etc. Only a lawyer could answer those questions.
And you've travelled very far. Are you glad you've come?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Dr. Jessie Watt, Brenda's close friend and colleague, had to hold off moving country so she could appear as a witness in court. I spoke to her on the phone sometime after the trial, and she explained it had been upsetting for her and it brought it all back up again. And while she didn't want to go through the turmoil of an interview, she did tell me how pleased she was that her friend now had justice. And I think what she said in 2002 is still very relevant.
She was cut down at the peak of her career, and she was a nice, very likeable woman. And to go out like that with such a black cloud from the press was just not right. I feel as if I owe it to her to try and say something on her behalf.
Finally, as I explained in one of the Patreon videos, I went to visit Brenda's family, Rita, Chris and Belinda in Ipswich. I knew before I went that this was an off-mic conversation, and I respect that. They've gone through so much.
I'm about to have a reunion with someone that I've not seen since, I think it was 2002 that I did the actual interview, and someone who's been in my thoughts, you know, over that period of time, many times actually, and it's Brenda's sister. And we have spoken on the phone, but I haven't seen her since then. And she's agreed to see me. She's a bit traumatised after having done a documentary interview about this, so I don't think she's going to do an interview with me, but I just wanted to share with you my feelings about seeing her. I don't even know if she'll remember me. It was a long time ago, but it was a significant moment for me in my career meeting her, and it's a even more significant moment now.
I arrived at their beautiful home and was greeted by their lovely dog, and we had tea and cheese scones, which Chris had baked. Walking in and seeing Rita, she hasn't changed much despite the gap of more than 2 decades since I last saw her. Dressed beautifully in a cream jumper, navy and cream neckerchief, and navy trousers, her hair done nicely, and pearl earrings on, I felt emotional giving her a hug. I don't know what memory she has of me, but I remember my interview with her clearly. Doing a TV interview in someone's house is an ordeal. We had a camera operator, a sound man, director, and me. Furniture gets moved, lighting meticulously set up and fiddled with. Sometimes adjustments are made in the middle of the interview. I remember chatting to Rita in another room to distract her from the alien invasion of her living room, and trying to reassure her that I'd be gentle, and our hopes that something might come out of the documentary. No promises, but a hope. And that is all that families in her position could do. Hope. I interviewed many loved ones over 3 series, and for most it had been many years since anyone had taken an interest. They were all cold cases, unsolved, unresolved. Their lives on hold, unsettled. Unfinished business that's painful to live with, knowing the killer hasn't been caught, and there's nothing they can do about it, except agree to revisit the horror for a TV interview in the hope that something, someone, might alter the course of destiny. The police retested Brenda's bedsheets, pillows, nightdress, and other items at the same time as the documentary, but the results took longer to come back than our on-air date, and they never shared them with us. So I learnt at the same time as everyone else what they found. Obviously, they would have been tested at some point, but I'm glad that the documentary pushed focus onto Brenda's case. Similarly, I had no clue back then that my interview with Rita would be played to the prosecutor, Alec Prentice. And as retired DI Gary Winter revealed to me, it was that interview that sealed the deal in persuading the Crown to move forward with the case, leading to Kit Harrison's arrest. When I interviewed Rita back then, her final answer to me that day was in response to me asking how she felt about the case still not being solved.
Well, that is the worst thing, isn't it? I mean, it's what, 25 years ago now? And her young life is cut short and nobody's paid the penalty for it. A senseless crime. When I think of how clever she was and what wonderful work she was doing, just think what she could have achieved in those 25 years. Just cut short, just like that. Somebody should pay for it, shouldn't they?
Somebody should pay, and they finally have. And the tears I had seeing her again recently were because of this. After the hug, she congratulated me on the podcast and spoke about how long it had been since we last saw each other. I complimented her on her appearance. She does not look her 89 years. We chatted about all sorts of things, but naturally the subject veered onto the case, and I told Rita about it being her interview that persuaded the Crown to proceed, and she hadn't known that. They were all pleased to learn of it. I also told them about the eagle-eyed listener, who pointed out the flaw in Kit's story about Brenda hitting her head on the boot of the car, an impossibility with her Mini, which had a small hatch that opened downwards. We also spoke about the memories that Chris had of his Aunt Brenda, and Rita said she'd tried to shield her children from the horrors of what happened to her and what was said about her in the papers. As an adult and having sat through the trial, Chris explained how hard it had been for him and his wife to witness the denigration of her character once again. But they were glad the podcast played all of the trial and was representative of her full story. You may be surprised to hear that families aren't told about all the evidence, the statements and the little pieces of the jigsaw. As a witness, Rita would not be permitted, obviously. But they didn't know, for example, that Brenda had made a complaint about Kit breaking in, which Gary Winter told me about. The footprint on the bed in the spare room. Then him knocking on the door moments later. A coincidence that he could be there to be her knight in shining armour. A story which was not told in court due to the police officer not being alive. We also talked through the hypothesis of what Kit had done after the murder. Buying shoes a size too big. Had he incinerated the bag and its contents at the university? Where did he dispose of the weapon? Rita had listened to the entire podcast. I'd sent it to her family in advance of its release. She told me she's not good with computers, but the family had set it up ready to listen and told her which button to press to get the next episode, but she inevitably managed to lose it on the page and had to wait for the next family visit to continue. She said she was astounded by Kit's testimony about Brenda wanting babies and the book on baby animals being the hint. As a medical and scientific expert, they thought it unfathomable that she'd choose this method to communicate to him that she wanted a child. Rita said Brenda was just at the beginning of her career, and having just started a new study at work, she didn't believe his claim. Also, Brenda's knowledge of genetics and a fear the child might inherit some of Kit's traits, another reason they believed it was made up. She also didn't believe that Brenda had pulled Kit out of bed and kicked down a door because he hadn't made her breakfast. The roles reversed seemed more likely. The family hadn't known about the son Kit had with Kathy Horton in America and didn't think Brenda would have known. Rita only found out by the police when they went to see her before the trial and asked her if she'd known about the boy who was adopted. We observed there was so much more to the story than was heard in court. Chris and Belinda told me they'd been nervous on the day of the verdict. They couldn't read the jury's faces and couldn't imagine how they'd have felt if the jury's decision had gone the other way. But they were glad in some way that he'd been jailed now, because if he had been found guilty in 1978, the sentence at that time could have been as little as 10 years. They felt there was some justice in the fact that he will likely die in jail. The Lings are a kind and compassionate family. Rita expressed concern for Kit's partner of 45 years and her hope that she hadn't suffered the behaviours of Kit that Brenda had endured. They were surprised she wasn't at court and hadn't known she'd attended with Kit the first time the case was called and then adjourned. They thought she might have been called as a character witness and said it spoke 1,000 words that she wasn't. I explained it might have been due to the cardiac event that was mentioned at sentencing. After some time, I felt it was time to leave them in peace. The meeting was more for my benefit. I wanted to see Rita and hug her. I thanked her for letting me come to see her, and I joked she probably thought, oh no, which she laughed at. I told her she'd been in my thoughts all these years, and I got a bit emotional. Rita told me she just wished her mother had had some justice before she died. She would have been thrilled. We all agreed that we hoped Brenda might be looking down on us, content that her killer had finally faced justice and her story finally told. Thank you for listening to this bonus episode of The Storyteller Naked Villainy. I hope you find that interesting, and I am sorry I couldn't share with you the proper interview with the Lings. They did, however, say that they were happy enough for me to pass on their sentiments and some of the detail of our conversation. They really are a lovely family, and I was so grateful that they opened their doors and their arms to me. Thank you again for listening, and thank you for all your support. This is The Storyteller Naked Villainy, written, produced and edited by me, Isla Traquair.